All right, we are going to resume our study here in the Minor Prophets with the name that's probably the hardest one to spell, Habakkuk. I mean, if you picked K on Wheel of Fortune, you hit the jackpot on this name. But Habakkuk would be the next on the list chronologically. If you have no idea where Habakkuk is, go to Matthew and back up about four books and you'll be in the right spot, okay? So, Habakkuk is the topic today. We're going to do just a brief review here. I'm sure you can all read that. Maybe not, but I was trying to group sections together on the screen. But in the parentheses are what are called the major prophets, just to overlap the timelines. But this is kind of the general order that we did. Obadiah, Joel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea. Those were all pre-captivity. If you remember, after Solomon, the kingdom divided, and you had the north and the south division from then on. The northern kingdom went into captivity first. But all of these prophets, in the minor prophets, as well as Isaiah and the major prophets, and then Micah, preached and prophesied during the time before the first captivity. Okay, we've been through all of these minor prophets already. And then in 722 BC, you have the Assyrian captivity, which was, you know, the Assyrian Empire. The headquarters of that was where? Anybody remember? Nineveh, yes. So sometimes Nineveh and Assyria are used interchangeably, just like some folks might refer to Washington, D.C. as representative of the capital of the United States, or we might refer to Beijing, you know, as being representative of the nation of China. So you have the Assyrian captivity, and during that time, you know, Micah would have been prophesying right around the time that came into place. Then you had Nahum and Zephaniah, whom we've already looked at. Jeremiah's ministry overlapped the tail end of that period, and Jeremiah was actually in Jerusalem when Babylon came in. So those would be kind of the in-betweens, or, you know, during the Assyrian captivity. And then the next item, you know, as far as Israel's history, is the Babylonian captivity. All right, the Babylonian captivity was the southern kingdom, was Judah and Jerusalem. If you look back at the history of Israel from the time that the tribes divided, if you remember, it was while Solomon was still living that God told Solomon, because of your disobedience, his many wives took away his heart. He began to build temples for them and for their gods. And the very gods for which God had said, I'm going to drive out these people because of their wickedness. Well, then Solomon built temples to those gods in Jerusalem and in the surrounding cities. So God told Solomon, I'm going to take the kingdom out of your hand, but I'm going to do it after you die for David's sake. Well, from that point on, when they divided, the northern kingdom, those kings were all idolaters. None of them tried to follow the God of Israel. In the south, it was kind of hot and cold off and on. It was about, you know, approximately half and half. But for that reason, because, you know, the southern tribes held on longer to following God, then God allowed them freedom longer. Eventually, though, their disobedience caused God to bring judgment on them as well. Do you remember the name Manasseh? Okay, Manasseh was referred to as more wicked than any before him. Interesting. Manasseh was in the south. Ahab and Jezebel were in the north. Okay, but, you know, he was as bad or worse than Ahab, when sometimes we don't think that's possible. Anyway, Manasseh was right at the tail end, and because of his wickedness, God's like, all right, that's it. Well, Josiah was his grandson, and helped to revive the worship of the Lord. But anyway, that's the time period. So now we're getting down to the end of that. And as the southern kingdom is going into captivity, Jeremiah, you remember, overlapped both. Well, then we have the ministry of Habakkuk. That's what we're looking at now. So Habakkuk's message was delivered just prior to Judah and Jerusalem going into captivity. All right, Judah and Jerusalem went into captivity in three phases. You see it there, 605 was the initial captivity when Babylon came through and conquered. And then 597, there was another phase carried away. And then eventually, when they continued to rebel, 586 was when Babylon came back, knocked down the walls, knocked down the temple, you know, everything. So, you remember Pastor went through Nehemiah in a series on build. Well, Nehemiah went back to build the walls. Why did he have to build them? Because Babylon knocked him down. Okay? So that's the phase of Israel's history that we're coming into. All right? So Habakkuk's ministry was just prior to Babylon coming in the first time. All right? And then, of course, you have Daniel, who was part of those that was carried away captive to Babylon. Ezekiel, same thing. And then after the captivity, you have Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. After they were allowed to return from Babylon, go back and start rebuilding, then you have those minor prophets as well. All right? Now, again, that brings us to Habakkuk 1. And we see here the man Habakkuk. This is just introductory material, background to the book. The man Habakkuk, if you do a search in your Strong's Concordance or your favorite Bible program for the name Habakkuk, you will come up with it exactly twice. In chapter 1, verse 1, the burden of Habakkuk, and chapter 3, verse number 1, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. That's it. So what we know about Habakkuk is that he was a prophet. Okay, I mean, we know other things from his, about the circumstances in which he ministered, but as far, you know, others, we were told a lot more about their background. About as far as Habakkuk, we're not told a whole lot. The date of the book is in that 608 to 605 BC, very likely 606, 605 BC time frame. Okay, and the reason I say that, look with me just a second at chapter 1 and verse number 5. Behold ye among the heathen in regard, and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. Now, God, the Chaldeans is a term that's interchangeable with Babylon, okay? But notice how it's described in verse 5. The thought of Babylon coming into their country, how is it described in verse 5? Question, I'm looking for an answer from you. Marvelous. Okay? In other words, he said, you won't believe it. So if I said that negatively, if they said, hey, Babylon's coming here, nah, that's unbelievable. Right? That's the idea here. So the reason I say it was, you know, very likely 606, 605, just before Babylon, is because of, you know, the history of the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire. For a long time, it wasn't even feasible to think that Babylon would be coming in. Okay? So, I threw the map up here for you just to remind us a little bit. The region that we call Mesopotamia is the region that is in between. Oh, no. There we go. The region that is in between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Okay? Now, if you see here, I've enlarged it a little bit, but right up here where the red dot is now, that is Nineveh, modern-day, you know, Mosul, I think. And then Babylon down here is, you know, closer to Baghdad area, I think. All right? But anyway, Babylon is down here further south. Okay? On the Euphrates River. Nineveh is a little further north on the Tigris River. But in order, you remember, in order for Babylon here to come over here into Israel, could they take this route here? No, I mean, what's in between here? Desert. Okay? So for Babylon to go that way, they would have to come up this way and then back down. Right? If Babylon were to go this way and come back down, who's in their way? Yeah, the Assyrians, headquartered here at Nineveh, but you know they have to go right through this area, which is all under Assyrian control. In fact, Babylon for a long time was a servant to Nineveh. Okay? But, and we'll come back to the map in a minute as we go through some of the history here, but when we talk about the historical setting of Habakkuk, we get that in 2 Chronicles, which we'll look at in a minute. But Babylon rebelled against Nineveh. Nebuchadnezzar is the one who would end up, you know, leading that. You're familiar with the name Nebuchadnezzar from the book of Daniel, okay? But around, you know, 612, 610, along in there, Babylon, which was a subsidiary, if you will, a servant to Nineveh, they began to rebel. And Babylon had help. There were other allies that were tired of Assyria as well. And so Babylon begins to rebel, and there's kind of a protracted battle. We talked about this earlier when we talked about the prophecies of the fall of Nineveh. But at a certain point in time, God allowed Nineveh, which considered itself to be indestructible, to fall. And so you have this protracted battle here, and eventually Babylon, who has rebelled under Nebuchadnezzar, the siege of Nineveh was almost 3 years. You remember that from our earlier study, hopefully. But it was in the third year of the siege that Nineveh finally buckled and caved. Okay? So this was a protracted battle. Okay? So meanwhile, while these two over here, you have Babylon here and Nineveh here, while these two are having what at this point is an intramural skirmish, which turns into a rebellion or a coup, okay? If Nineveh is tied up fighting Babylon, what part of the world are they not able to defend as well? Well, this part over here, okay? So while Nineveh is tied up in this protracted battle, then you have the siege of Nineveh and this long protracted battle with the rebellion of Babylon. All right, let's go over here just a little bit. You see there's the Nile Delta area and the northern part of Egypt. Well, the Pharaoh of Egypt decides that this is a good opportunity for him to come this way and begin to expand his empire. Okay, so Pharaoh Necho of Egypt, or Necho, however you say that, advances his kingdom, taking advantage of the weakness of Assyria. While he's distracted and he's weakened by the rebellion of Babylon, then Egypt begins to rebel. All right, then this is where we tie in with 2 Chronicles 35. If you want to hold your place here and turn over to 2 Chronicles 35 for just a minute. If not, I'll read it to you. But 2 Chronicles 35, beginning in verse number 20, the similar account is also recorded in 2 Kings 23. 2 Chronicles 35 and verse 20. After all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by Euphrates. But Josiah went out against him. You know, if you do some historical study, just in secular history, the Battle of Carchemish is a pivotal event in world history, right? The Battle of Carchemish was pivotal in establishing the Babylonian world empire. Okay, I'll show you where that is on the map in just a minute. But the Pharaoh of Egypt is on his way up to Carchemish to fight against Babylon, and Josiah went out against him. Verse 21, but he sent ambassadors to him. He is Pharaoh, him is Josiah, saying, what have I to do with thee, thou king of Judah? I come not against thee this day, but against the house wherewith I have war. For God commanded me to make haste. Forbear thee from meddling with God, who is with me, that he destroy thee not. Now, did I think that God appeared to Pharaoh? I doubt it. But this is his way of saying, look, I don't have any quarrel with you, but stay out of my way. It's interesting. Why wouldn't he try to conquer Josiah? I don't know. But, you know, that was his mindset, was that he wasn't, I've got bigger fish to fry. All right, verse 22. Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself that he might fight with him, and hearkened not unto the words of Necho from the mouth of God, and came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. And the archers shot at King Josiah. The king said to his servants, have me away, for I'm sore wounded. His servants therefore took him out of the chariot and put him in the second chariot that he had, and they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died and was buried in one of the sepulchres of his father, and all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. And Jeremiah lamented for Josiah, and all the singing men and singing women spoke of Josiah in their lamentations to this day. Now, if you remember, Josiah had reinvigorated the worship of the true God. Okay, Manasseh was his grandfather. Manasseh was the most wicked king of the south. And he had, the Bible says, filled Jerusalem from one end to the other with blood. And he had defiled it with all of his idolatry and his abominations. Well, then when Josiah became king, you remember Josiah became king at a very young age, I think 8 years old. And then when he was 16, he began to seek the Lord as a young man. And no doubt, you know, Jeremiah and some of the others were instrumental in helping that. But Josiah has helped to reinvigorate the worship of God. Now, if you compare that to our day, for just a parenthetical for just a minute, you know, was the spiritual situation awesome when Josiah started to work on that? No, not at all. But God still worked in that time, okay? But under Josiah, the worship of God was reinstituted. The idols and the groves were torn down over a period of time. In fact, earlier in 1 Kings, I think it's 1 Kings 13, there was the unnamed prophet who was sent to deliver a message and go home another way, and then he disobeyed. But he said, there's going to become a man one day, Josiah by name, who's going to burn the bones of the false prophets on this very altar. Well, that happened, you know, a long time later. But anyway, Josiah had restored it. If you remember, then Josiah also reinstituted the Passover. I mean, we talked about Passover a couple of weeks ago, leading up to Easter, and the overlap between Passover and what we call Easter. But just because the Bible says you're to observe this every year doesn't mean that Israel always did that. For a long time, it had fallen by the wayside. Well, Josiah reinstituted the Passover. If you remember, Hezekiah earlier did the same thing. It had been abandoned for a long time, and then they tried to revive the worship of God. So Josiah has done a lot of good things. He made an unwise decision here. So as the Pharaoh of Egypt, okay, so the Pharaoh of Egypt down here is bringing his army up this way to fight against, you know, Babylon and, you know, expand his kingdom. He has to go right through this area right here. All right, this area right here is Jerusalem, Judah, and so he's coming right through here. That's not what I wanted to do there. All right, he's coming right through here, and as he does, Josiah comes out to fight against him. All right, as he comes through here, Josiah goes out, he loses the battle, Josiah dies on the battlefield, and he's buried. Well, then Pharaoh Necho of Egypt continues to come up this way, and Carchemish is right here. Okay, right at the top or near the top of the Euphrates River. It's right in this region right here. Okay, so what this means is that in the conflict between Babylon and Nineveh, Babylon has finally overcome Nineveh. And then as Pharaoh is coming up from this side, well, then Babylon comes over to meet them, and Babylon comes this way. And there's a massive battle between Babylon and Egypt right here, right near the origin of the Euphrates River, okay? That historically was monumental in world history. It's also pivotal in Bible history as well, okay? But the Battle of Carchemish effectively knocked Egypt out of the picture as a major world power, and then Babylon from here would come south and take over all of, you know, all of this that had been under Assyrian control, and then he's going to come down this way and eventually take Jerusalem. Okay, but back to Habakkuk chapter 1 now. Under the historical setting, when Necho, king of Egypt, comes up and Josiah goes against him, Necho then, you know, helped to install Jehoiakim as a placeholder king, so to speak. Then Egypt goes north towards the Euphrates. Babylon and its allies defeat Nineveh. Babylon moves westward to meet the advance of Egypt. And you have the Battle of Carchemish, as we've just described with the map here. Okay, so Josiah dies. Jehoiakim is installed as a placeholder. And then Egypt continues to advance north. All right, all that being the, you know, the historical setting. Then that brings us back again to verse 5 where God says, I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. So understand, from our perspective, it's like, yeah, Babylon was the next world empire and Nebuchadnezzar ruled the world, et cetera, et cetera. Just understand, at this point in time in Jerusalem, there was a feeling of self-confidence. You remember in Nahum and in Zephaniah, we talked about the princes and the rulers. that they were, you know, destroying the people. They were living high and oppressing the people and that kind of thing. They were still feeling a sense of security at this point. And so Habakkuk's message is right, I think, in that 606, 605 time frame, just before Babylon shows up and completely changes their life and changes their perspective. Okay? Now, against this backdrop of a seemingly impossible enemy power, Habakkuk delivers his prophecy. Now, with that being said, let's look at Habakkuk 1 and verse 1. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. That is very common language to describe a message of God as a burden on the heart and the mind. The name Habakkuk, it's interesting, it's taken from a word that means, a verb that means to embrace. So the name Habakkuk carries the idea of to embrace, or in other words, to comfort or to console. So his ministry would have been one to comfort the righteous. Yes, God will deal with sin. And to declare God's judgment on the rebels. All right? But other than that, we don't know much about the man Habakkuk. All right? Then the next section is verses 2 through 11. And this would be Judah's present situation at the time of the writing. All right? Let's read the whole section here, and then we'll go back as much as time as we have. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity, and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention. This is Habakkuk speaking in the first person, but it also represents, you know, the righteous and their heartbeat. All right, verse 4, therefore the law is slacked, judgment doth never go forth. For the wicked does compass about the righteous. Therefore, wrong judgment proceedeth. Now, the voice switches to God. This is Habakkuk the prophet speaking for God. Behold ye among the heathen and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days, which ye will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses are swifter than the leopards, more fierce than evening wolves. Their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And they shall scoff at kings, and princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this power unto his God. Okay, so this is, you know, the next section of Habakkuk chapter 1. But in this, we see in verses 2 through 4, the complaint of the righteous. Okay, verse 2, O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? That term cry there has the idea of crying out for deliverance. There's an intensity to this appeal. You know, God save us. I mean, it's just us. We don't have to put on airs this morning, but you know there are times when you pray and maybe it doesn't have the intensity that it should. And then there are other times when we really sense our need and our desperation. And there's a whole different aspect to our prayer, right? This term here, how long shall I cry and thou wilt not hear, has that idea of intensity, of crying out to God. God, would you save us? Would you deliver us? Now, at this point, they're not under Babylonian captivity, but was the general conduct in Jerusalem righteous? No, I mean, we just got done looking at Zephaniah and Nahum and how the princes were evening wolves. They were destroying the people, and there were houses to worship the stars and the moon and all that kind of stuff all over Jerusalem. And so even though Josiah had attempted to reinstitute the worship of God, that doesn't mean it was a godly nation. Sound familiar? Sounds like our country today, right? There are those that really want to serve God and do right, but anybody who says America is a Christian nation, that's self-deceit. Okay, that's not really the overall tenor of our country. In verse 3, why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? The idea of grievance there is trouble or sorrow, that which grieves me. that which is a burden, that which is grief. For spoiling and violence are before me. So not only was there idolatry that would have grieved the righteous, there was oppression, and not by Babylon, but by Judean rulers. Okay? So here it's a multifaceted complaint. There's spiritual problems. There are political problems, which resulted in physical problems. Spoiling and violence are before me, verse 3. And there are that raise up strife and contention. And you thought that only came in with Twitter, Facebook, blogs, evening news, 24-hour cable news where they got to have something to talk about. I mean, those are great sources of contention in our world today, right? Strife and contention. But it's been around for a long time. There are those that raise up strife and contention. How many of you enjoy it when your life is characterized by strife and contention? No hands, no takers, okay? Even if you have to deal with it, you don't enjoy it, right? And the blessing of God in many, many cases is described as the opposite of that, right? In one word, what is it? Peace. Yeah, peace, okay? The blessing of God is peace or relief from that strife and conflict and contention, okay? So, in other words, there's no peace, there's conflict on many levels. Verse 4. Therefore, the law is slacked. It's an interesting term there. It means numb, and then by definition, ineffective. Have you ever had your hand or your arm go numb? Maybe you sleep on it funny, or maybe you cross your legs and then your foot goes numb. Okay, how good is that numb foot for balance, for walking? It's really kind of amusing. As long as there's no permanent damage, it's really kind of amusing to see somebody kind of, what's wrong with you? My foot went numb, And then as the blood starts to flow back in there, it feels like 1,000 needle pricks, right? And but that numb foot is ineffective. My dad is dealing with that right now, not because he crossed his legs, but he's dealing with a condition called neuropathy. It's, a side effect of some of his military service. And some of the other conditions as well, dealing with a condition called neuropathy. Neuropathy, a neurosurgeon is one usually that deals with nerves, right? And that's a condition where basically you lose feeling. Your nerves go numb or go dead, okay? I never even thought about this until I've been talking to him over the last few months. I mean, we think about that in different ways, but I've never really thought about how important it is for the nerves in your feet to work correctly. Because if you can't feel what's under your feet, you can't balance. Okay? And you've had that feeling at times. Maybe, you walk along the shore and, it doesn't feel solid. Or, maybe sometimes you get up in the middle of the night and you're just not steady. But, if you don't feel solid or you can't feel well with your feet, it affects all of your balance. Numbness, it's a bad thing. But here, what he's saying is, The law, there's not a sensitivity to do right. The law is slack. There's numbness, or by extension, ineffectiveness. Just like numbness in your hand makes it ineffective for working, numbness in your feet makes it ineffective for balance. So a numbness towards the law, the standard of God, makes God's law ineffective. The law is slacked, and judgment doth never go forth. Now, we're coming up on an interesting time in the political calendar in America. It seems like every month is interesting for some reason or another. But long about June is when the Supreme Court typically issues their major rulings. In the fall, in the summer, or July, August, September, along in there, they vote amongst themselves on which cases they're going to hear. And then they schedule it out, usually October, November, and then in the spring, January, February, March. They will schedule hearings for the cases they're going to hear. But usually in June is when the Supreme Court releases their rulings. That's always a nervous time for people who follow the news, because there are issues that affect our lives, right? And there are times when we feel like, yes, they finally got one right. And there are other times when we feel like, no, that's wrong. And if this becomes how the law is enforced, then this is going to negatively impact people in this way. So we can understand the feeling here is what I'm saying. When it says judgment doth never go forth. In other words, it's never judgment here has the idea of that which is right. So it's never right. It's always wrong or corrupt. In fact, the next phrase expands on that. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous. Compass about has the idea of to surround. So if you have someone in the middle and then they're being surrounded, which crowd is more numerous? Those in the center or those that are surrounded? Usually the surrounding group is larger, more numerous, right? So the idea here is that the wicked outnumber the righteous. Okay? And then the wicked doth compass about the righteous. Therefore, wrong judgment proceedeth. That term wrong has the idea of twisted or crooked. Now we've never heard in our country of anything that where we thought a judgment was twisted or crooked, right? That never happens here. Of course, I mean, it happens in every society. This same word is used in other places as perverted because that's what to pervert means, to twist or, you know, to bend out of the way. But here, the righteous, their perspective is that wrong judgment or twisted or perverted judgment proceedeth from the judges, or from our terminology, from the courts. So that's the circumstance. That's the complaint of the righteous. All right? Then in verses 5 through 11, you have God's response. The response of God is in the form of an announcement of impending judgment. Now, in verses 2, 3, and 4, God, why don't you save? Why don't you hear? Why don't you take care of the violence? Why do I have to deal with iniquity? Why do I have to deal with things that grieve me? Why do I have to put up with twisted or corrupt judgment? Okay? Are those characteristics of people living in righteousness? This means yes, this means no, this means I'm blonde. Okay? Are violence and corruption and perverted judgment, are those characteristics of people living in righteousness? No. Okay? So in essence, the cry is, God, won't you set things straight? Won't you deal with sin? That's the essence of the cry. All right, in verse number 5 then, it's still phrased in the first person, but the speaker shifts to God, the prophet speaking for God. Behold ye among the heathen in regard and wonder marvelously. You have several terms here that are all synonymous. Behold means to look or to see. To regard means to look at with attention or to give consideration to. Okay? And wonder marvelously. All right? Wonder marvelously is two uses of the same root word, which means to be astounded or to be dumbfounded. Okay? Now, how many different ways here is God saying, pay attention, right? Behold, regard, wonder marvelously. You know, those four different ways God said, look, pay attention, listen up. Okay? The idea here, this phrase to wonder marvelously is to be astounded or to be dumbfounded. Have you ever gotten news that just left you dumbfounded? Occasionally it's positive, you know, but oftentimes we think about that more in negative terms. I mean, we felt like that on, what was it, Tuesday? We get news, hey, pray for Brother Wayne Birchwell. He's got a brain tumor and they're transferring him to Pittsburgh and they're talking surgery. I mean, didn't we feel kind of numb and dumbfounded at that point? Like, okay, what's going on here? Right? So, you know, there's other, so all of you could give personal testimony, no doubt, of things that have happened in your family, ministries you've been involved with, and there's time. But that's what God is saying here. I'm going to do something that is so major, so significant, that you're going to be astounded. You're going to be dumbfounded. Whoa, what's going on here? That's the idea. Middle of verse 5. For I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told unto you. Okay? The word for. Now, this verse is significant, so I'm spending a little more time on this. But for means because. Okay, this is the groundwork. He said, I want you to be astonished. I want you to be dumbfounded. Why? For, because of the work that I'm getting ready to do. Okay, I will work a work. God said he's going to do something. And when is this work going to be done? What's the next phrase there? In your days. Now, often when the prophet spoke, when was the fulfillment? In the distant future, right? So God, through the prophet Habakkuk, is making a distinction. No. This is going to happen in your days, in your lifetime. Okay? So there's a difference here between others who have prophesied 50 or 100 years prior to Assyria coming in or prior to the fall of Nineveh or whatever. In this case, he says, in your days, in your lifetime. In other words, it's going to happen really soon. I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told unto you. Think back, 10 years ago. Most of you are old enough to do that. Okay? Those of you that are college students may or may not have been following elections and politics 10 years ago. But if you were told 10 years ago, right, there's going to be a presidential election, and then there's going to be an element of our country that is so adamantly opposed to it that they're going to start a campaign, not my president. Resist it. If I had told you, 10 years ago that there are going to be violent protesters that protest in the heart of a major city, and the local government is going to tell the police, back off, don't do anything. Tell the federal government, no, don't send in the National Guard. You just thought, man, that's nuts. That's unbelievable. Okay? You could have been told that, like, no, that's too far out there. That's too different. Well, that's very similar here to what you see. He says, I'm going to tell you something I'm going to do, and you're not going to believe it, though I'm telling you. All right? And then specifically, verse 6, he says, I raise up the Chaldeans. At this point in time, what was the political power of the Chaldeans? Now remember, there's no internet, there's no telephone. So what does Judah know from their vantage point? All they know is the Assyrian Empire is in charge, and they haven't heard much about Babylon, right? And if Babylon is fighting against Nineveh, they've been so conditioned to think, well, Nineveh is the power of the world that, okay, there's no way they're going to win. I mean, fill in the blank here. It would be as though you were being told, okay, let me just use a hypothetical example here. In 5 years, the Canadian army is going to rule the world. I tried to pick an absurd hypothetical, okay? But this was almost as absurd to them, right? The Babylonians are going to come in. This was not on their radar. This to them was just totally out of the picture, totally unexpected, not really even believable. If you had told them that the Assyrians were going to come back and destroy, remember, the Assyrians got the north but not the south, that would have been more believable. Egypt is going to invade from the south, that would have been more believable. But Chaldea, Babylon, really? That just was not on their radar at all. So, does God only work in the ways that we expect or in things that we can see from our vantage point? Is God able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think? Yeah, absolutely. And so whether it's from the perspective of judgment for one crowd or from the perspective of God's deliverance and God's keeping his promises from the other side, God is not confined by our imagination, our knowledge, our experience. God is getting ready to work, if I would say it this way, outside the box and do something unique in Judah. All right, we've got to quit there. We're not out of material, but we're out of time. So let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord, for your word. Thank you for the reminders of your power and your faithfulness to keep your promises. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to choose to believe that, even when some of those things seem unbelievable from our perspective. Lord, I pray for Pastor in the preaching hour to come. I pray that your hand of power and filling would be upon him and that you'd give us listening ears and receptive hearts in Jesus' name.